You're watching Channel 37. WHXN. New Salem.
Gargantuan terror from beyond the dawn of time? It can only be Channel 37's midnight movie show. First, we're going to mispronounce all kinds of names with Godzilla versus the Smog Monster. Then, the Reba McEntire cinematic universe kicks off with Tremors.
Hello and welcome to Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show. I'm Dan, and with me are Wendy.
Hey there.
Dave.
Hello.
And Will.
You didn't even get penetration with the elephant gun.
It's true. We did not. However, we did. We did watch the first movie that was brought to us by Will. And Will, what did you bring to us?
Out of the polluted waters it came, to become the most fearful menace that ever threatened mankind. Feeding, growing ever more deadly on Smog, only one force dared stand up to its overpowering evil.
Godzilla!
Godzilla versus the Smog Monster. Will Godzilla, man's friend, be vanquished?
More than 1,600 dead have been reported, while other casualties are expected to exceed 30,000.
The main storage tank of the Japan Oil Company has exploded.
Nothing man can do can stop the Smog Monster. Can Godzilla save the Earth from this mastodon of destruction?
I brought Godzilla vs. Ghidorah, otherwise known as Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster.
Excellent, I suppose. And Will, why this one as opposed to literally any other Godzilla movie?
So this is honestly like, okay, I'm a fan of the Godzilla series. I saw my first Godzilla film at like age 10. My mom let me stay up late and watch it on like our local horror host's like evening show. And yeah, that was Godzilla versus Mothra. But so I've been a fan of Godzilla for years. So like Dan had made a list of, hey, here's some film kinds of films we haven't covered, and one of those was kaiju films, and I was like, okay. You know, there's so many good ones to choose from. And then it was basically between this and Godzilla versus Megalon, which is unironically probably my favorite Godzilla film that Correction, my favorite Godzilla film to casually watch, not my favorite one in terms of how good it is. But then I was like, but Godzilla vs. Ghidorah is such a weird Godzilla movie and so different. It's also kind of like a turning point in the series. So, yeah, it was just like, okay, you know, this is the one we go with.
Okay. Can you give us a brief explanation as to what this movie entails? For people that aren't familiar.
Yeah. Okay. So the main premise of the film is that Ghidorah, which is alternatively a hive mind of tadpole monsters / an amorphous blob monster / a flying UFO monster, basically feeds off of pollution. It also lets out a poisonous smog and acid that will just outright murder people, which you see a lot of bodies in this one. But anyway, it attacks a doctor, Dr. Toru, and his young son. And his young son, for whatever reason, also has psychic visions of Godzilla, which brings Godzilla to Japan to deal with Ghidorah, who is in danger of basically wiping out the entire human population of Earth as it just continues to feed off the pollution that humanity has produced. Eventually, Dr. Toru figures out, okay, well, if we can completely dehydrate Adora, it will kill it, because otherwise, like, if you just leave a single tadpole behind, it'll eventually grow bigger and become a new Adora. So Godzilla and the Doctor and some other people end up luring Adora to an electron field where it gets dried out, dies, Godzilla rips it apart, and then Godzilla just looks at humanity, is just like, really? And then leaves.
Yeah. Thank you, Will. Was this anyone's first time seeing this?
Yeah, it was mine. I've seen a few other Godzillas, but this is my first time watching this one.
Sadly, I have seen it before.
Okay. I genuinely don't know Godzilla movies.
I mean, it was definitely a creature double feature movie here in Boston.
Yeah, exactly. It was definitely part of the Godzilla is friend to all children era of Godzilla. And you know, as you say, they all just kind of bleed together for me, to be honest. All right. Well, Will, you just said that this was like, you picked this because it's not your favorite, but it's just too weird. What are you thinking about it?
Well, I mean, honestly, like, it's a film that it's a Godzilla film that starts with a James Bond-esque, like, song sequence, psychedelia, and then...
So I just cross that note off my list, yeah.
Bog monster!
I was making up lyrics.
And, I mean, like I said, it's just, like... It's not one of the two Godzilla films that got done on Mr. Science Theater 3000, but it's also, like, probably, like, it definitely is in that vein of the ones they would have covered if, you know, they actually could keep the rights for longer than a single week. But anyway around, I mean, the other thing that is really kind of striking about it is, I mentioned you see a lot of bodies. You don't see a lot of bodies in a Godzilla film with the exception of, like, the first one. And not only that, but, like, this is the first one in quite a while. Like, it is a silly one, but it also then has these moments where it's like, okay, so we're going to actively start reminding people, hey, you know what made Godzilla, right? The nuclear bombs. And, hey, the pollution in the world is just about as serious as that was. Like, it has a very much an environmental message, which sometimes works, sometimes doesn't. But, I mean, yeah, it's such a weird and different Godzilla film that I'm like, you know, if I got to talk about one Godzilla film on this podcast, it should be either this one or the one where a gay couple build a robot to fight Godzilla, to fight monsters with Godzilla.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. Wendy. Let me know. What were you thinking while we were watching this?
I mean, this one is like a Godzilla movie it's a Godzilla movie with an environmental message told through the filter of laughing.
Sock it to me.
There's like, it felt like that, right? Like the doctor, I don't remember his name, the doctor's oldest son is just of the right age to be hanging out in the nightclubs, right? I think Ken was the little one. And his girlfriend is the lounge singer who gives us, like, I was singing it, I think, as, like, Smog Finger. But also the melody scanned to Moon River for some reason. And so there was a lot of Moon River, like, getting into the mix as well. But it's just cuckoo bananas, right? It's just, I don't need a lot of logic from my Godzilla movies, but I just need a little. I just need it to be consistent, and it was just all over the place. Godzilla has atomic fire breath, right? Could he not have just dried out this fucking fake rubbery-looking Cthulhu monster in, like, the first battle? But we have to get through the whole movie for him to, like, rip out the gonads, right? And, like, hold them up in victory for the Earth. And then that isn't even the actual death, because he has to kill Hydra again a second time. It's I love Godzilla movies. Mothra is a great movie anyway. Mothra doesn't need Godzilla. Like, it's just a great movie. Everything about Mothra is delight. This is no Mothra, sir. This is a transitional movie, I think, right? Like, changes are happening in the studio. But Hydra, what I like about Hydra is that he, like Pokemon, he's constantly evolving. into a higher form with more evolved battle techniques. But he continues to look like Sigmund the Sea Monster's creepy cousin Cthulhu. I was making up Cthulhu references too, wasn't I?
Yes, you were.
In his house in Rylea, dead Hedra lies, stifling.
Yeah.
Which is such a niche Sigmund and the Sea Monsters reference that like one person gets it. But hi to that one person.
I think we all get it here, at least.
I love Godzilla movies, but I don't like this one. The animation is weird. Like, it's just a weird ass movie. I guess they're doing a lot of experimental shit. I don't know. When they go to Mount Fuji because it's so pure the smog monster can't resist it. And the girlfriend is dressed as like the Bay City Rollers. I don't understand this movie. Yeah. I was not like there were lots of things in it that were funny and memorable, but this wasn't it.
Okay. And Dave, how about yourself?
I mean, it's been a while since I've watched a Godzilla movie, and sort of this was clearly made at a stage of the Godzilla movies when it was just sort of like we're going to have 40 minutes of monsters fighting each other, but what do we fill the rest of the time with? And so they were just, you know, they've just kind of thrown out some environmental stuff, but like, yeah, the smog monster is not their best work. It is no King Ghidorah. It does look more like something the Power Rangers should be fighting. And it's not helped by the fact that obviously it's like this kind of dark grey colour. Godzilla is the colour he is. And unusually for like a Godzilla, well, the Godzilla films I've seen, a lot of the fighting takes place at night. But usually a lot of the fights between the Godzilla films I've seen usually happen during the day, so you can see what's going on. But when you've got two kind of dark monsters fighting at night, it's kind of hard to see what the hell's going on. It's sort of not as striking as maybe it could be. I mean, like, I get the environmental message, and like Will says, given the kind of environmental fears that produced the original Godzilla, it's interesting to see that them going to that next stage. Yeah, but obviously the hippies are hilarious.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when they there's that bit where they go like, it's afraid of fire, and they all start picking up flaming sticks and throwing them at it, and then it just kills everybody.
That character, the friend, the older boy, like he was just this model of idiocy throughout the entire time that he was alive. Like, he's afraid of fire. What has led you to think that he might be afraid of fire? Like, what did we see not see on screen that made you think that he's afraid of fire? Because he's clearly not. Even and before that, he was like, "Oh, Hedra can't come out during the daytime." Why do you think that? Because naturally, cut to Hedra golemfing around during the daytime. Like, where are you coming up with this garbage?
And like, Lance, if the first 10 aren't scaring him off, the next 60 probably, like. He's just sort of standing there going, "The hell are you all doing?"
Listen, these are the people who said the world is ending. Let's have Burning Man.
The other main thing that struck me was the sort of the theme for Godzilla. Like whenever Godzilla comes up, there's this little kind of theme that plays for him. And instead of it kind of sounding either sort of heroic or awe-inspiring, it sounds like the comedy theme from like a 1960s British sitcom of like, you know, just like the comedy character bumbling into the room. Like it sounds like the theme tune for an idiot.
Mm-hmm.
And it feels like it's ill-befitting Godzilla's majesty, frankly. Like, it's more like a here's gigantic Archie Bunker bumbling like around about to knock some shit over again.
It's like the audience clapping when Kramer slides into the room.
I mean, this was a rough Godzilla, right? Like, he didn't have a lot of menace. He was kind of like, all of his fights were, he was kind of like dancing around, like, put him up, and not actually fighting.
Like, he seemed more exasperated than anything else. Mm-hmm. Like, just constantly just like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Like he's fighting it, and like nothing's happening, and he's blowing his fire breath at it. earth. And then he gets thrown into a pit and gets like goo covered in him. And he eventually crawls up. And he's like, oh, for God's sake.
I mean, he's got this young kid on his lawn, right? Like trying to take his jaw.
And then Godzilla gets fucked up and then covered in Hedorah's diarrhea.
Yeah.
Which is why he literally ripped his balls off later.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I mean, entirely justified reaction.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave. So, I'm gonna be, I think, a little more forgiving to this movie than either Wendy or Dave. I appreciate little movies that take big swings. Like, I'm going to tell you right now, After Midnight could be a lot weirder than it is.
Yep. Stay tuned.
That feels ominously like a threat, Daniel.
Oh, it absolutely is. 100% it is. You should be very afraid. What's that?
Devil fetus.
Yeah, devil fetus.
We bought it.
You did. But, this is a Godzilla movie that's doing something different than most Godzilla movies, and I can kind of appreciate that. That said, I've never been a big Godzilla guy. I've certainly seen a lot of Godzilla because, you know, it was on Creature Double Feature. It was basically here. I mean, I'm sure we mentioned it before. Here in Boston in the 70s and 80s, we had Channel 56 Creature Double Feature on Saturday afternoons. And they would show, sometimes they'd show like Universal Monsters, and sometimes they'd show Hammer horror movies. But for the most part, it was Kaiju Palooza. And you never went more than like a month without a Godzilla film, it seemed. So certainly I grew up watching a lot of these movies. And even now, like, I don't sit down and say to myself, I think I'm going to watch Godzilla movie, but I'll certainly sit and watch it if it's on, right? It's that kind of thing for me. But I'm not sure if I've seen this one before, but I wouldn't be surprised to find out that I have. But I found myself enjoying this a little bit more than I have other Godzilla movies, precisely because it was just so bizarre. Of course, when I say this, I am not talking about Gojira. I'm not talking about the original movie, because that movie is fantastic. That's just a fantastic, fantastic movie.
Yeah, you kind of really
specifically mean Gojira. Yeah. I don't mean, you know, Raymond Burr looking off screen at things for 90 minutes.
Yeah, in a way, you can't count Gojira among the rest of the Godzilla canon. Like, that sort of exists as its own thing, and then it just sort of became
it's
what we know as Godzilla.
It's an entirely different movie than pretty much any other Godzilla movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, this movie, there was a lot of, like, even for a Godzilla movie, there's a lot of camp in this movie. Which is not necessarily a bad thing. Although I did find myself basically going, whenever the two monsters aren't fighting each other, I'm thinking to myself, why aren't the two monsters fighting each other? The fights were great. I actually really enjoyed a lot of the fighting scenes. You know, there's a shot, I think they did it twice, but there's a shot of Godzilla like facing the camera, rearing back and punching the lens of the camera. And then like we cut to, you know, him plunging his thing into Hedra's eye socket. Which was kind of awesome. I'm not going to lie. That's kind of amazing.
Oh, yeah, the fights are the best thing about it. Clear. Yeah, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just sort of it's just the rest of it's just a bit. I think my mind was sort of sliding off the rest of it, kind of not really, like, trying to take it in, but not really taking it in.
But I also, and I always love this. I love this, you know, this movie is set in 1971 Japan, which is kind of caught up to 1968 everywhere else. You know, like the friend is straight up dressed as Freddie Jones from Scooby-Doo. You know, during the nightclub scene.
A little ascot.
Yeah. And remember her name, Miki, the nightclub singer, who's straight up Goldie Hawn in Laugh-In. Which is kind of amazing, to be honest with you. So, yeah, I'm not going to sit here and say that this is a great Godzilla movie, because I don't think it is, but it was, I had a lot, I had more fun with it, I think, than Wendy or Dave did.
That's probably fair.
And I think that's because it's just so weird.
Yeah. I mean, we have a sequence where, you know, Hedorah's getting away, flying away, and Godzilla's response is, okay, cool, awesome. I am going to use my atomic breath to fly after him.
Is that the first time he does? Because I've seen him do it in other films. Is that the first time he did it?
Yes, it is.
And once again, I feel like I'm being very generous to that scene because I've also seen Godzilla doing a drop kick against a monster also before.
Yeah.
I mean, I won't say I hated this because I didn't. Right? It was fine. It was, you know, as a Godzilla movie, it's just a little, if anything, I'm comparing it to other Godzilla movies I've seen and found it a bit wanting rather than sort of like, I mean, obviously, if you've never seen a Godzilla movie, this isn't the one to start with at all. But like, if you like Godzilla movies, there's plenty to like in this. It's just, it's a different experience and your mileage may vary.
Yeah, like I wouldn't say that I hated it either. Like, it's just goofy in what I would say the wrong way, that I, not the way that I appreciate a goofy Godzilla movie. But I don't know, Danny. I feel like I had a lot of fun watching it because I was singing along and making up my own lyrics, and there was a lot of like "For the Earth" happening. And what was
you were making a lot of head references, as I recall.
Oh yeah. Every scene I kept expecting we were going to turn the corner and find the monkeys having an existential crisis. And at one point, I think we were literally like in the Porpoise song video for like a few seconds.
Like with all the TV screens with the word, "Hey, hey, we are the monkeys."
Yeah. Yeah. I was absolutely expecting to see like Mike pop up from around the corner with his little hat.
That baby did not like being in the mud.
I mean, not a lot of people enjoy being in the mud. I don't know. I feel like Godzilla is awesome, and Godzilla is underutilized as Godzilla here.
Mm-hmm. That's fair.
You know, he has atomic fire breath. He could have just destroyed this thing. I know that he like uses his breath to fly, but it's like that scene is embarrassing, right? Like he's. That's like how a 4-year-old makes their Godzilla toy fly across the room, right? Like, not an effect in a major film. And the whole thing with the Mount Fuji scene was just wild. They go to have a bee in on top of Mount Fuji, and that's somehow going to save the Earth. But yeah, it's not fair to say, like, I hate it. It's just, there are so many better Godzilla movies.
I would,
like any Godzilla movie, this did provoke the reaction of during the fight sometimes of me going, "Get him!"
Yeah.
"Get him!"
One of the main issue, if I would even call it that I had with this movie is the tone was weird. Like, one of the things that make the Godzilla movie so much fun is, you know, it's two monsters and, you know, the wrong monster comes in to stomp all over Tokyo or, you know, Kyoto or Osaka, wherever that one's taking place this month.
Sometimes just to lay her eggs.
Sometimes just to lay their eggs. But, you know, they have a big monster fight and the cardboard buildings fall down and we're good. This time, Hydra is running around and actively murdering dozens of people.
Oh, yeah.
Like, and we're seeing the dead bodies just kind of like suffer and die as they hit the ground. And I think that, while I understand that they're trying to get their message across, they're trying to say that pollution is a terrible thing and we need to knock it off. In a Godzilla movie, it just feels a little too, like, you can't do this and then cut over to people in rubber monster suits flailing around. And it just doesn't, for me, that was a little bit, it didn't quite gel for me.
And also, the message of the film seems to be pollution is bad, but Godzilla will fix it.
Well, there's also that, yes.
like it's bad, it's terrible, these things happen, but it's okay because Godzilla is just like zapping it with his like atomic breath and making it go away, so we're good.
Godzilla is your disappointed father who's just like, "Don't do this again. Don't make me come back and kill yet another Ghidorah at some point. Okay? I'm leaving. Don't do that again."
Well, it's kind of like it's not that dissimilar from like Superman throwing all the nuclear missiles into the sun, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, we've got this big problem that we won't fix ourselves. So here comes the big superhero to fix it for us. And that didn't work.
No. Yeah. I mean, part of why this one is also a little bit different is, so for the most part, with like the exception of the second film, Godzilla Raids Again, there are mainly two directors on the Godzilla films. And excuse me for butchering names, because Ishiro Honda is, you know, the big one. He does a lot of the films. But then Jun Fukuda did like a couple of the films, Eraba, Horror of the Deep, and Son of Godzilla. And then, yeah, you have this one guy in the middle there, and then after that point, it's like, okay, you're not directing Godzilla films anymore. Like, the studio basically just pushed them off them for a while, and then they're back to Jun Fukuda for, like, the next three films before Ishiro Honda basically ends the Showa era. And, I mean, the guy basically, he does a few films after this point. There's a bunch of times where he's trying to get Godzilla versus Ghidorah 2 to happen. Until eventually, like, he almost convinces somebody to do, like, a 3D IMAX remake that doesn't go anywhere, but they keep kind of production to try and make it happen, until eventually Legendary picks up, like, some of the pieces of it, and that's how we got the MonsterVerse films that Legendary started back in 2014, 2015. Mm-hmm. Out of this guy.
This guy?
Yeah, well, kinda, sorta. The pieces are there, it's just that he's executive producer on them, on the first one.
For the record, those movies are very fun.
Oh yeah. I mean, you have one where Godzilla goes to the center of the earth and gets a pink mohawk.
Yeah, that was one called Godzilla Rides Again.
Raids Again.
Sorry. Yeah, the second one. I just suddenly got like, but they're all named after Herbie films. Godzilla Goes Bananas.
Godzilla Goes Bananas.
Godzilla Goes to Monte Carlo.
You could kind of call King Kong versus Godzilla Godzilla Goes Bananas.
I suppose that's true.
I remember watching that one, and I was rather disappointed that it was a draw, essentially.
I mean, it depends on which country you watch it in, because there's different versions where Godzilla kind of comes out on top, ones where King Kong does.
Although, again, the more recent Godzilla versus Kong was fucking awesome. I'm just gonna say that.
I still haven't watched those ones yet. I mean, when I first heard of Godzilla versus Kong, it's just kind of like, but the scale's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Godzilla is the size of a building. King mm-hmm. Kong sits on top of it. Like, he's a wee fella compared to Godzilla.
Not in canon!
It's just like Godzilla versus Kong, as I understand it, it's a very short fight.
Truly, not that much longer than Godzilla vs. Bambi.
Yeah, you know.
Perfection. A scorched outpost in the middle of nowhere.
You know how close I am to leaving this place right now? How close?
Maybe that's why Val and Earl decided to leave town.
Oh, whoa, 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 whoa!
Hey, hold up. That's Edgar Deans.
They just picked the wrong day to do it.
Jeez.
You guys better get the hell out of here. There's a killer on the loose.
Who could be doing it?
Is that a snake?
I'll give you boys $5 for this. 20.
That's how they get you. They're under the ground.
What the hell are those things? After they eat a whole station wagon.
But where do they come from?
I vote for outer space. No way these are local boys.
You see, they're headed right for us.
No Richter scale can measure it.
They're coming!
No scientist can explain it.
Bert, they're under the ground.
You didn't get penetration even with the elephant gun.
Run, run!
And no one knows what to call it.
Megaworms or suckers or suckoids.
Now this valley is just one long smorgasbord.
Now it's up to Val and Earl to save the world.
That's one big mother.
Who died and made you Einstein?
And they know just what to do. Flip for it.
Damn.
Kevin Bacon. Fred Ward. Tremors.
All right. Next up, we continued on our journey of big ass monsters, and finally had the opportunity to check out the original The only movie that needs to be watched in this series. Tremors from 1990.
So, Tremors is, of course, the heartwarming tale of our two handymen, Val and Earl, who have been doing odd jobs for rubbish money in the tiny town of Perfection, which he's got about like a population of like 20. Finally kind of fed up of making not very much money for work they hate, they decide they're going to pack up and move. But as they're going out of town, they start encountering some very bizarre things, like some very mutilated sheep and their owner buried well up to his neck and beyond in the ground. The local doctor's car has been sort of buried almost entirely, but its radio still playing. And then they encounter this huge underground worm thing. And the local geology student, who's been doing sort of work around the town, works out that there must be about four of these things. They end up taking out one by accident, because it manages to brain itself on some concrete. They go back to town, start to try and sort of save the rest of the inhabitants, including the guy who owns the local kind of convenience store and the two survivalists who live in a bunker not far from the town called the Gummers, who conveniently have a very large arsenal in their basement. So the Gummers managed to take one of the worms out basically just by emptying their entire basement's worth of ammunition at it. But that leaves them with two. They managed to get hold of a bulldozer with a trailer on the back of it to kind of get the people out of town. They get kind of stuck on some boulders in the middle of the desert. And they start sort of using some pipe bombs that Bert has thrown together to go graboid fishing, as they are christened. They manage to take out one, but the other one's a little bit too smart. Eventually, Val uses has a bit of an inspirational moment, runs towards a cliff, which is not far from the cliff where they originally kind of like were at the start of the film. Uses the bomb to make the graboid stampede. It then bursts through the side of the cliff, falls down to its death and sort of explodes in a big slimy mess. And so at the end of the film, Val and Earl get hold of one of the gigantic worm corpses and go off to make their fortune by sharing this bizarre new discovery with the rest of the world.
And we should mention, I missed it, Dave, is that these worms are blind and
I didn't mention
kind of sense people by sensing movement, vibration through the ground. So there's a lot of don't move, get up on a thing.
Get off that pogo stick.
Yeah. For fuck's sake, little girl from Jurassic Park. get off the pogo stick.
Okay. He just does not have much luck.
That's true, right? Thank you, Dave. I appreciate that. Now, I can't imagine the answer to this question is yes, but has anybody not seen this movie before? Yeah, I didn't think so.
I will point out, I only narrowly hadn't seen it before, so...
Oh, really?
I only narrowly had seen it before.
How's that?
How does that work? Somehow I had missed it for years until I ended up watching it earlier this year.
Oh, okay.
Well, I've also only seen it once before, probably within the last year or two, because I mentioned I had never seen it, and Dan kind of made me watch it.
That's not how I recall it. That's not how I remember it.
But that's how it actually went down.
I'm not sure about that, but okay.
I will point out my first watching of it was the most appropriate way possible, which was a VHS rip of a sci-fi channel airing.
Okay.
Excellent.
Because the sci-fi channel fucking ran this thing into the ground, which I think is part of why I avoided watching it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they did make the series, didn't they? So they that's did. Probably why they're
going to make it. And most of the sequel movies as well. We the last time that we watched it, when Wendy and I, it was on probably Comet, like one of those satellite UHF channels. It just happened to be on, and we just happened to be watching that channel, and it came on, and we didn't change it. That was...
You could have changed it, though.
Well, we didn't. And as I recall, we stayed and continued to watch Tremors 2, Aftershocks, when that was over, because that aired next.
Did I sleep through that?
You may have. You can definitely skip that one. Although, of all the sequels, that's probably the most watchable one. That's the point where, you know, they trade in Kevin Bacon for Michael Gross as the the lead of this series. So.
Who were the original cast is willing to stick around for cash?
All right. I actually think I am going to start with Will this time. Will, tell me what your thoughts are regarding Tremors.
I mean, Tremors, it's a dumb action horror movie. I think it does an excellent job of building dread in like that first like half of the film. And the creature effects are honestly pretty good. Mm-hmm. It's a movie that was made for $10 million in 1990. It probably if you had told me it went straight to DVD, straight to VHS. I would not have been surprised in the least bit, but hey, they gave it a theatrical run. I don't know of all the films of Kevin Bacon's done that this is the one that he spent years being ashamed of. I don't get that at all, because Kevin Bacon's been in some real bad shit before this and after this. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's an interesting film. It's something I would not turn off if it came on, like, you know, just random TV channel, or if it was on Svengoolie. I wouldn't go out of my way to watch it, but it's something that I would definitely watch again.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Wendy, how about yourself? What are your thoughts about Tremors?
I mean, it's goofy as fuck. I think I understand why I didn't see it until recently. I mean, I love... It's not really a horror movie, right? Is it like an action? Would we call this an action?
It's kind of billed as a horror comedy. I mean, it's giant monsters.
Okay, so it's a horror comedy. So I enjoy horror comedies. I enjoy Kevin Bacon. But these two tastes did not taste great together. Like, it's just... I don't know, it's just not for me. I did love... the couple, though. What are they? What is the name? The Gummers?
The Gummers?
Yes.
I fucking love them so much. They are perfect survivalists. And I love that, like, the Heather, who is played by Reba McEntire in her first acting, like, credited acting role, is I think, more competent with weapons than her husband. I love that she's a badass with a giant gun. Like, I can get behind Heather.
She's a gun nut wife who lurks too hard. She loves her husband and never stops. With gentle aim and the heart of a fighter, she's a survivor.
Well done.
Although, if Tremors 2 is to be indicated, she did in fact stop loving her husband.
And it happens.
Broadway with Colin.
Yeah. And he's got to get her gun someplace.
I don't know. There's a lot of, like, I don't know. I just don't. It's not it for me, right? Like, it should be something that I would really enjoy, and it's got some fun things in it. And Kevin Bacon looks great in it. I don't know. It's just not it for me. I did not care for the Tremors.
Okay, you're wrong, Dave. Tell me. I tease, Dave. Talk to me.
I've obviously seen this a few times. I always enjoy it when I watch it. One of the reasons that I prefer this in terms of like some of the other kind of similar films out there like this is you do get a real like sense, like all the characters feel quite real, and you feel like, yeah, they're very kind of thinly sketched, but they all feel like people, like real people. And so you do get, you know, you are quite invested in their survival. And so, yeah, you do want them all to get out of it, with maybe with the exception of that snot-nosed teenager who absolutely deserves to be dragged underground.
Half of the population of this town is dead, and somehow Melvin is not one of them.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck Melvin.
Yeah. That Melvin, I first trying to figure out who Melvin's freaking parents were, because as best as I can tell, they just abandoned their kid in perfection and were like, you're living here now. Bye.
Yeah, I think apparently it's established somewhere they spent a lot of time in Vegas, which, you know, If you get to leave that snot-nosed kid behind, why wouldn't you?
To be fair, if I was Melvin's dad, I wouldn't spend a lot of time with him either.
But yeah, I think the slow burn of what's going on is kind of nicely done. Like when they find the guy at the top of the electrical pylon, he's been dead for days because he just stayed up there and died of dehydration. And sort of, I like the way that they piece things together in a way that seems logical based on what they found. I mean, obviously, you've got the geology person there to do the actual kind of science, the actual science bits. But like they kind of, all their kind of ideas kind of slowly kind of come out of the stuff they've got to hand and them adapting to the situation. So originally they get on the roof of the building, but then the Graboids kind of work out that they're on the building. So they start kind of messing with the foundations. And yeah, you see them kind of like taking out the vehicles, which is when they get the idea that they've got that old bulldozer that would probably be too heavy for them. So they decide to use that. And so they, the Graboids respond by essentially setting a trap for it by kind of tunneling out in its way. So it kind of goes that. So it's almost got like a battle of wits between like the people and the monsters. Like the monsters actually showing them kind of learning about the things they're hunting a bit. And like the idea of using the bombs as kind of bait just comes from Bert saying that I'm not going to starve on this rock, I'm going to light one of these, go out into the desert and let them take me, which is a very Bert thing to say. Like, it's entirely a character for Bert to say that, but from that Earl gets the idea of using the bombs to try and, in a way that doesn't involve throwing Bert to them. I mean, alternatively, I'd have given one to Melvin and sent him on his way, but there you go. But yeah, so like, I feel like each of the plot beats kind of comes out organically from the characters and the people and what's around. Like, everything's kind of established, but nothing is like just suddenly thrown in there. And of course, like, even though they're initially hidden and hinted at, when the Graboids are actually finally revealed, they are genuinely impressive. Which, on the budget of this kind of film, that could have been a big stumbling point that you've subtly hinted at these monsters, and then when they're finally revealed, they're ridiculous or, laughably fake. Whereas in this, I think, they managed to pull off something that looks pretty realistic, pretty scary. And, the people you meet briefly, you kind of meet them enough and they're played by good enough actors that you actually care about them when they're getting numbed on. Like, you only see the doctor and his wife, who's played by Wrath of Khan's BB Betch.
That's so, yeah.
Yeah. Like, you only see them in one scene before they get killed. But yeah, they're so kind of like, the doctor's so nice and avuncular and they're such a lovely couple that you actually kind of go, you don't want them to die, but obviously they are, because that's how you build it up. But like, they managed to establish them again quite quickly, but because they've got kind of good actors performing them in what are relatively small roles, you actually kind of go, I don't want anything bad to happen to these people, they're nice. So you do end up rooting for everybody apart from Melvin. Like, even the gummers, who on the face of it should be awful people, like crazy kind of right wing survivalists, are actually kind of quite a nice couple as well. And yeah, I mean, they're kind of hero moments in the basement when they just sort of like just unload their entire arsenal at this thing. They got Reba McEntire with a gun in each hand just unloading bullets after bullets into it. And then Bert suddenly remembers he's got a big fuck off elephant gun that's like that fires enormous shells at it. I mean, that's a great scene.
Fires a flare into his mouth to kind of keep it open.
Yeah. Yeah, that is definitely a high point of the film, is the gummers versus one of the monsters. And the fact that the reason they're getting attacked is because it's their ammunition loader that's that's attracting, because it's making so much damn noise. So yeah, I enjoy this for what it is. I think it's like it is dumb, but I think bits of it are smarter than it's often given credit for. I've never watched any of the sequels, and I don't particularly going to seek them out, to be honest with you, because they kind of nailed it. Like, yeah, you don't need an origin for these things. Like, yeah, they kind of like throw forward like, you know, the three basic ideas of sort of mutation, alien, or sort of like ancient thing that's been under the ground for ages, but it's never confirmed. And like, you know, where they come from doesn't matter. Like,
yeah, they actually say that in the film. It's like, you know, maybe we can worry about this after we save our lives.
Yeah.
Right now, let's just deal with what we're dealing with.
Yeah. And they didn't need to go into how they are able to tunnel, but I appreciate that they did.
Yeah. I'm kind of right there with you, Dave. I can say definitively that watching it for this show is the first time I've ever thought to myself, you know what? I'm going to put Tremors on. You know, because it's not that kind of movie. You know, it's a movie that you catch when it comes on TV, be it Sci-Fi Channel or late night on a digital satellite station.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much where, like, anyone who's our age who's seen Tremors has encountered it on a late night showing. They've come home from a night out, or, yeah, they've just been flicking channels for the night and they've just stumbled upon Tremors.
Well, I guess, and again, I was going to get into this later, this movie did not do well in the theater. It did not perform in the slightest. But it was one of the first to be an absolute monster on home video. This was like one of the first movies that did not perform at the box office in the slightest, but more than made back its money once it came out on home video. Because it's honestly, it's the kind of movie that everybody can watch, right?
Absolutely. It had a fantastic poster, like the box art. It just looks amazing.
The box art is fantastic, yeah. But yeah, I've never, like said, I'm going to watch Tremors, but it's a lot of fun when I do. It's a 50s monster movie. It's a 50s monster out in the desert. You know, it's a giant thing from beyond time that is just coming along and menacing this tiny desert community until they figure out how to make it small / blow up good. It's just, it's got a little bit more of a late 80s, early 90s sheen on it.
Well, in a way, it's actually kind of like one police box away from a Doctor Who story.
It really is.
Yeah, like, you can see, yeah, like the Doctor turning up and then, you know, the people in this small town are being menaced by underground monsters, and it would probably go exactly the way it does now, just with like an English fan making quirky remarks.
Just like I can see an A24 remake of it, where it's literally just a group of people sitting on this large rock for the entire movie, with them basically and them having to figure out all their issues, and occasionally they make escape attempts to get away from the monsters that usually don't succeed very well, and one of them dies in the process.
Yeah, and in this one, the pipe smoking avuncular scientist is played by Rhonda, who I think is great.
Oh, yeah.
I think Rhonda's a great character.
She's the smartest person in the entire movie.
She's absolutely the smartest person in the entire movie. And she's the one that figures out, you know what? We need to pole vault our way out of here. You know what? We need to, I'm going to, you know, use the water to draw the graboid away from the building. You know, like, she's kind of the one, other than Kevin Bacon, who really makes all the good decisions. And of course, when Kevin Bacon does it, it's almost by accident half the time.
Yeah.
You know, she knows what's going on and she comes up with solutions and she kind of throws herself out there and is kind of a badass. And I think she's great.
And she honestly, Finn Carter deserved to have a better career than she did, which was 5 movies and a bunch of guest starring spots and then nothing.
Wasn't she on a soap opera for a while? Maybe I'm thinking of somebody else.
She was on China Beach.
Maybe. Okay. I might be thinking of someone else then. Yeah, this movie's just a lot of fun. It's super goofy. But that's okay. I can handle a goofy monster movie. That's kind of monster movie has to be goofy. Really, you know? And there are times when I was legitimately like, oh, how are they getting out of this? Like, you know, oh, you're not running fast enough. So the movie's doing what it's setting out to do, which for me is all I can ask for, really.
I mean, I will say that there is a certain, this movie has a certain style and a certain sense of humor that if you're not on that wavelength, it's not going to land. You know, so like it isn't going to be for everybody. Yeah, I mean, as it is, you know, like for Dan and me, it's absolutely landed because like this is exactly the kind of nonsense that we lap up with a spoon. But I can completely see how, I mean, I know Julia's like never actually watched it all the way through because she said she's watched enough clips to make her kind of go, yeah, you know what, this isn't for me. Like, just not like, it's fine. I'm sure it's fine, but it's. I know I won't enjoy this. So yeah, I think it's like, yeah, you either on its wavelength or you're not, and if you're not, that's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
And it has Victor Wong in it.
It does.
I will watch just about any movie for Victor Wong.
He's great in this. He's really great in this. Honestly, everybody's really great in this.
But he's the one who calls them graboids as well. He was very adamant it had to be oids. I don't know what the first bit is, but oids is how it ends.
Yeah.
And there's a small detail that I absolutely love, which is Victor Wong's market says it's on the got a big sign, and you can tell that that Victor Wong is over a name that used to be there.
Yeah, that's a great touch. Yeah, I mean, like yourself, Dave, I would say that this movie is, the script is a lot smarter than it needed to be. Mm. There's lots of little touches like that. So yeah, it's not going to win any awards. I'm not going to pretend that it is. But it's certainly, for me, a fun way to lose 90 minutes of your life.
You know? And like the perfection set is fantastic. The way all the buildings are like laid out and just sort of like, you know, the fact that it is this kind of like, I think it actually says like on the sign is like the population is like 20 or something.
17, yeah.
So yeah, it's this small town. But, like you kind of want, it does almost kind of make you intrigued. Like how did each of these people end up here? Because like, this is clearly not a place where people are born. You find your way to perfection somehow. Like this is not a town with a population that is creating new people. This is how a bunch of people have somehow ended up here.
I mean, in the case of Melvin, he found parents that the parents were like, "We need a town where we can leave our son, and we can just and we can be sure that we aren't going to be found liable when he winds up dead."
Mm-hmm.
It's like the mother and daughter. I can't remember the mother's name.
Nancy.
Nancy, that's it. Yeah. In a way, she's kind of like the most, in terms of what, how did they get there? Like, it feels like Nancy's kind of like, it feels like maybe like her husband brought them there or something, and he's no longer in the picture for whatever reason. But like the fact that she's trying to get, at the start of it, she's essentially bribing Val and Earl to make her like a kiln, I think, isn't it? Like she wants to be doing, like she's doing like some pottery and stuff out there. So it's kind of like, yeah, they've all got these, their little things going on. And yeah, got the ad that the guy with the hat. Oh, what's his name? Oh, I'm terrible with character names. The guy gets pulled through the truck tire.
Oh, Nestor.
Nestor, that's it.
The guy that everybody forgets is in this movie.
Yeah.
He pulled him to get the high ground and he jumped on a tire. He's very forgettable and deserves to die.
But it's higher than the ground.
Oh. That's it.
Obi-Wan's argument wouldn't have been quite so strong if he'd been stood on a tractor tire. It's over, Anakin. I have the high ground. So he's clearly just sort of like, yeah. You get the sense that he's probably the one paying Val and Earl to do stuff the most. All the kind of random stuff around outside his trailer. And then, yeah, they've each got their own kind of little character things, which kind of, you know, it's not much, but it identifies them. Yeah, and the whole kind of layout of the town. Yeah, it's just the way that, you know, bits of it start collapsing as it kind of falls victim to this to these weird monsters is very well done.
I was watching the making of, and Kevin Bacon is there to, you know, talk about his time on the movie. And he mentions this, and I didn't really have a sense of this, is that this movie was made in 1990. At that point, he had not had a hit since Footloose. And he was at a stage of his career where he was like, the next movie has to do something or I'm basically done. And so, you know, his agent hands him the script for this monster movie out in the desert. And he's like, oh, God, this is it. This is it. I'm dead. I have no more career. I am done. Which is like surprising because, yeah, I guess I looked it up. And I think between those two movies, he'd made like She's Having a Baby, which tanked, And it was like one other one that was supposed to be big and just entirely wasn't.
He was in Diner in 1984. Yeah,
that was before. You know, like, what was your last movie? You know, like, what's the last time you made some money for us, kid?
So he had a cameo in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
That's true. He did. So, yeah, so when this tanked also, he was, like, despondent, apparently. Just did not understand what was going to happen to him. And, of course, then he had Flatliners, which did really well. And then this movie just roared back in the video stores. So, because 90 is, like, the point where they're starting to price movies for you to take home with you and not just rent. And I guess it sold a lot. Like, it didn't just get a lot of rentals. People went out and bought this movie because it is a movie that the whole family can watch without being a kiddie movie, you know?
For any of the younger people, how they used to movies used to be like around $80, $90. The only people that could realistically buy them were the rental places. And then once they, you know, had their like 30 copies of She's Having a Baby were, you know, got... weren't getting rented anymore. They were like, okay, cool. We'll sell them used for like $10-$15, and we're still getting profit then at that point.
It was an optimistic video place that was buying 30 copies of She's Having a Baby. I feel that business deserved to fail.
Well, I mean, to be fair, in like the late 80s, like, you know, this was like this, that's a John Hughes movie that somehow did not hit. I think that was his first flop, if I'm not remembering something else.
Maybe that or Fresh Horses.
Maybe, yeah. But like, you know, that actually would have not been the worst gamble to make.
In a way, I feel for the younger generation, because they will never know what it is to walk into a Blockbuster video and have the smorgasbord that they can possibly choose from before them, mm-hmm. wandering through and seeing things that you've heard of and seeing random stuff that's straight to video and just like, what the hell is this? And like, yeah, it was an experience that isn't replicable now. Like, it's not the same just flicking through a stream.
I will say, like, right now we can watch almost anything we want to at the touch of a button. Now is objectively better. But the video store experience was really special, and I do miss it very much. Even though in the case of Blockbuster, when you say, you know, what you're seeing is like the big wall of Dances with Wolves, and then, you know, everything else.
But that was the thing. You got to see what was the big thing, because that was the wall of it. Yeah. And then you sort of moved your way down the... thanks to Blockbuster, I was able to watch kind of Deep Space Nine and Voyager when they first came out, because they came out on those kind of two-episode...
That's right.
Cassettes. Yeah. So I would just rent a bunch of Deep Space Nine and Voyager when it came out, and that's how I watched it.
That's fantastic.
I was lucky enough to grow up with like mom and pop VHS rental places where, you know, you had, we have all these films. You can rent five and for $5 for 5 days. Hey, we've organized our entire thing around who stars in the film. Nothing's alphabetical. It's just, okay, Julia Roberts is over there.
Yeah. Yeah, mom and pop stores were the best.
They really were.
It's like that joke in Third Rock from the Sun when he says, like, I've sorted it into good films, bad films, and films I haven't seen.
We had one of our video stores had a Faces of Death section. It was just the Faces of Death movies.
Didn't you go to a video store recently?
Yeah, I did. There's a video store in Jamaica Plain, in the Jamaica Plain neighborhood of Boston. Vinegar Syndrome was doing like a pop-up shop there. And I walked in there and it was just like, oh, my heart. I'm not going to rent anything because it's such a pain in the ass to get out here. But like, oh, and again, they had everything, like, you know, they had your comedies and kid sections and things like that. But they also had like, these are by directors, you know? So we've got, you know, Hitchcock and Tati and Buñuel and like all that type of things. And over here is just the Criterions. like it's very much a, you know, a store that was organized by a cinema snob. And I kind of loved it. There was one that was, it was like it was just kicking and punching. And it was like, I was all there. Martial arts / canon film.
like things was great.
Kind of bringing it back. I mean, nowadays, yeah, you go and you're scrolling through Netflix. Eventually, you decide on a film, and you watch 5 minutes of it, and you didn't really enjoy it. You just stop watching, and you turn to something else. Then, okay, well, I'm not driving all the way back to Blockbuster just because I don't care for Tremors. I'm going to finish watching Tremors.
Yeah, I paid my $4, and we're going to watch this. God damn it. I just remembered they had a section that was just, ew, gross.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I fondly remember the Alston Cinema Underground, where their rental log system was a notebook next to the shoebox where he kept his money. And he had all these weird sections. And the new release section didn't have anything that wasn't at least 5 years old. And he had the women in prison section, which is the one that's always stuck with me. In the weird independent video stores were just the best thing ever.
They really were. They really, really were. And I gotta say, when I was at this shop, you know, yeah, there were people there that were just there for the Vinegar Syndrome sale, but there were a lot of people just kind of walking in, returning stuff and looking for things to rent. So good on them.
Good on them.
Good on them. Although I will say, they advertise that they have a screening room, and I could not for the life of me figure out where it was. Like, this shop was like about as big as the room that I'm in right now. There were no obvious doors to any place.
It's a very grand name for a cupboard.
Yeah. Yeah. Loved it, though. It was awesome.
Well, I feel that now we've gone down the rabbit hole of nostalgia for video rental, it maybe mean that we've come to the natural close of the episode.
I think you're absolutely correct, Dave. I think you're absolutely correct.
Dear listeners, we're old.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, no, I can't argue with that.
In my day, we went to the store that had, you know, this section, you know, the children's sections were all blanched out because it was over by the window.
In my day, Netflix came in the mail.
Okay, Grandma.
In my day,
I'm off to rent some saucy zoetrope inserts.
In my day, you rented movies. There were some really bad candy that you wouldn't buy otherwise, and popcorn that came in a bucket that you just popped the corn in.
Mm-hmm. Oh. So once again, thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you, listeners, for listening. We appreciate you. Please take extra good care of yourselves right now. Drink your water. Please go to bed.
Channel 37's Midnight Movie Show was presented by Wendy Abramo, Will Ackerman, Dave Probert, and DJ Toland. Val and Earl will return in Avengers Doomsday.
Well, here we are.
We're trying to keep from making a lot of movement.
Daniel, on mute.
I'm new to Danny.
Here I am. How's that?
All good.
Now Graboid's going to get you. I hope you're happy.
Now it's, see, look, I just doomed us all.